works for all three.
Yeah, I think we'll done.
Reinforces measures said in relation to CNI. But for everybody also has significant concerns regarding overseer as a matter of principle in terms of its utility within the duty towards the duty fund manner, which strongly opposes any consideration of overseer in introducing the court is considering it in terms of a basis for assessing the future achievement of targets or as a foundation for the future allocation framework.
And we're not doing that. Submissions for the moment.
Conditional. The referee is reassured and to that extent comfortable with the use of overseer and equally the nitrogen scorecard within PC1 solely as a drafting gateway or gateways into the rules. This will need to be clearly articulated within PC1, and if there is to be more than one drafting gateway tool in play, consistency in application and compliance, even if the tools themselves aren't exactly the same, is essential, and farmers must use one or other tool only once initially selected. One can't get in through a gateway on one and then get it reassessed partway through on another. They produce figures, and one can obviously track movement between figures, and possibly you've got a line of travel, but not in a perfectly sizable one that's able to be assessed, and if you swap, you may end up with figures that aren't comparable in that respect. So, very much the case. Consent duration, while noting the potential implications of transitional provisions currently within the NVEA concerning consent duration, and those are the matters in section 335 and surrounding, which are always linked with 10 year terms from when. NVEA plans become operative. The river, if we consider that consent duration of policy 7 should be expressed in terms of for up to 15 years in PC1, and they seek the removal of the word generally from the beginning of that policy. terms of allocation, again, this is covered off and probably influenced with the earlier comment, but it's not because the revenue are not interested in allocation or the rights and interests which underlie assumptions that one can reasonably allocate, which are becoming increasingly embedded in the new framework at the very least under the NBDA, that we're really opposed to entering in any form of acknowledge a future allocation framework will be required to ultimately realise to do so. And rightly, PC1 does not involve those matters presently. That should be clearly understood and signalled, but the framework itself not predetermined by within PC1. The issue of allocation requires a future process with the rights and interests of every hapu at its heart and involving the Crown, as the NBDA expressly recognises in this. This section or sub-part 7 of charters, but sections 96 to 100, which arise out of ongoing national level discussions between representatives of Iwi and the Crown regarding the paternal kick down the road issue of rights and interests of Iwi and hapu in water and therefore implicitly in allocation, which always each new government embraces with a degree of unbridled enthusiasm, possibly not this latest one, but to date, since 2007 at least, for the first 18 months of every term, there are MOUs and some funding and work programs, and then we get within about 12 months of an election cycle and it all goes cold and we start again. This time, advocacy resulted in, at the very least, a commitment to put the start of that process within the legislation, and so it's a legislative obligation of the Minister to establish a working group to explore options for addressing the issue of allocation and rights and interests of Iwi and hapu. I understand there was preparatory work in terms of setting it up prior to the last government being dissolved, so we'll wait and see as to whether that's there, but it's always important to be cognizant that there are other political processes and now political, quasi-political processes that are embedded in legislation that will in turn inform, because the product of those, if they come to fruition, is that there will then be allocation statements that we are able to prepare, and if the Minister agrees, they potentially have some weighting on a regional basis within the regional planning structure, but and it's short of any national settlement of such issues. But it does mean there are some perhaps better signposts than we've had in the past about that. I mean, within this catchment, as part of Variation 6, there was initially an attempt by the UN to secure an allocation as part of Variation 6, but that was not able to be achieved for a range of reasons. And so that's kind of been put on ice so far to get PC1 up and running, but it realistically has to be the way of managing going forward if we have a limited capacity, and it's a limited capacity that is going to continue to decrease unless there are some new practices and technologies and other things that are going to allow one to maintain intensity and reduce effect. But there's a large challenge ahead, and so at some point one's going to have to grapple with the proprietary aspects of it in some kind of allocable way. But we need to do so in the review's view from an equal and equitable footing. That may change the nature of discussions at various stages. But that's...
And I assume you wanted it earlier rather than later.
Yes, that's right. I think there's a transition period before those NBDA plan committees get set up under the new legislation, and then they've got obligations, I think, start flying through from the National Planning Framework to start grappling with then dealing with allocation within the new NBE plans, and this step process is supposed to have at least unlocked some of that difficulties, challenges, and options for resolution both nationally and regionally. So, you know, hopefully it proceeds. It will help. Sometimes known as the cause of co-governance, it will help. And if we can have those constructive discussions occurring through that joint working group, and that it's still quite clear on its terms that it's not there to speak for or do deals for individual men up around the multi, but rather to unlock and identify potential and options, because sometimes that's been the difficult part of the political conversation, to get the government to grapple with those, or at least in the public face anyway. So that's all in there. I was going to do something in terms of land, but next, which I probably will, because I've already set up as a special accounting framework, which is a lovely topic, probably the right one to finish on. So the next section is just dealing with this issue of funds being in terms of land, and overlaps with the submissions made for CMI to the large part in this respect. There's a little bit more reference to some of the tension points in the hearing panel's decision about what it was saying it was doing and what we were wanting, which was hold the line, and then what ultimately transpired, which seems to be very different. Tony Land was kept in its box and perhaps locked down a little bit more, and other people with existing activities were able to expand or intensify as active players, which just exacerbates that. So the critical issue is that essentially we've already, as a result of that, and probably some land use change that's occurred since 2016, subject to how it's going to be assessed, which is one of the outstanding issues before this court. Instead of funds improvements since 2016, I suspect there have been improvements, but at the time, have they all been, or will they all be quickly subsumed by the expansion and the intensification that the hearing panel's decision was anticipating? And just as one can't empirically quantify the headroom that might be created over time, because we haven't got a way of adequately doing that, the certainty of the modelling that's been done about that these expansion intensifications will be extended lifespans will depend on similar variables that may or may not be true to a greater or lesser extent, and so we just don't know where that line's going to be going in the short term. And we're cognizant of that in terms of, or we're cognizant in terms of grappling with an alternative discretionary rule, but wanting to make sure that in doing that there's still connectivity through to the issue of the need for reductions, but acknowledging that on a property by property offsetting compensation basis, and depending on just lands for a whole range of reasons, it's never going to be able to deal with that on a land use change. But if we have got the cumulative shift and some discernibility about that, and I would never go so far as to say we need to be able to empirically prove that on an application by application basis. But one would hope that we are able to have better data and get some indications, at least general sense of shifting that will open up that capacity. And Mr. Brough has done some rethinking in relation to what might be possible in terms of a new discretionary activity rule, which is, you will see a hybrid role in terms of some land use change and the activity, and he's tried to import in the different types of activity classes that might be all within the one rule, so that wherever box you fit, you're covered and meet the same standards as those other activities under other rules. But also provide some better articulation through, firstly, by saying that the offsetting and compensation matters and rule by the subject to those. So that's an amendment made at the beginning of Policy 5 as subject to Policy 18, and then Policy 18 inserting in two additional ministers there is ministers to be recognised for the purpose of considering those land use change applications and development, which will go through the discretionary activity status. Has agreed, firstly, to recognise the historical and temporary barriers and legal impediments in development of country by ancestral land, and then return via treaty settlements. I think there was a drafting that was already there, but I just did note, and I should have picked this up earlier, that one doesn't need to say Tamaki ancestral land land returned to fair treaty settlements, because Tamaki ancestral land is defined to include that anyway. So there's the words and land returned via treaty settlements can be deleted from the 1880s. Because here, I think this is a pretty just in the reading here, but
in terms of that definition, you're only suggesting that land which is received by a treaty settlement is going to be.
I'll come to that if I can, Your Honour.
Okay.
That's all right. I didn't ask Mr. Ruff to amend that clause, but I addressed it in my. Towards the next page of the submission.
Right, well, before we get to that, though, just so that I understand in essence, what you're wanting is not to have to go through a non-compliant rule. You're wanting to have a discretionary activity or a restricted discretionary activity effectively, not just with the CDP, for example, so that you don't have to go through the 104D requirement, etc., in order to get to the starting gate. Is that right?
That would be a useful analogy in terms of the way through. I think Policy 18 tries to be a bit more embracing. I think still CDP probably still have some, from what I've observed, and I'm not here to directly address the CDP proposal, but I think there are some challenges there in terms of whether in that extension they are reducing or just minimising the increase.
Yeah.
But what I've indicated in the proposal, what Mr. Ruff has proposed in his new B within Policy 18, which is the one that has to be considered, is to recognise the reduction in point source and diffuse discharges of nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment and microbial pathogens cumulatively achieved through the progressive implementation of Chapter 311 in the relevant subcatchments.
Well,
yeah.
I saw that as wanting to indicate that if there's headroom
created. Yes, that's exactly right. Because that was the point that I think I said the other day, which is it's the elephant in the room. Well, it's actually being talked about, but it's invisible in the face of the plan. And if we know that's what we really need to utilise, I mean, there are some equivalents, I think, where people are able to intensify and able to do things that probably would have greater effect than forestry to a CPP conversion, for example, but we accept that this is the realm we are most likely to have to be operating within, and that therefore segues into my final point later on about accounting systems and things of that nature. Yeah. So, Mr. Brough will, as he is the author, not me, will probably it's best to perhaps explain what he was thinking from a planning perspective. And to that and answer any questions. And look, and just observing that, Mr. Majuri and I agree on many things. We are not necessarily in disagreement because we have put up a discretionary activity and he's put up a restricted discretionary activity. It was just within the time frames able to kind of align their thinking in the way maybe we they've come from a position of being kind of reluctant, non-compliant activities, trying to grapple with, it's only fair that we have this.
Yep.
They are, the size of that step, they are hesitant to go straight and say,
and I
should
staying there without this change, the ability to get effect to objective 4 is
negligible. No, it would probably be perhaps a bit more for me to say so, but. I think the referee would be aggrieved in the extreme that those other extensions and intensifications have been intensified. Well, appreciating that in other other aspects, the overall structure and framework for PC1 does and will reduce, but there is an exception here and an exception here, but not for tamoxifen. It's history on repeat in their eyes, as much as one might try and rationalise it against science and principle in the modern day. And there may be, those are other conversations to be had as well. So going back to my submission, I just wanted to address the final point about definition, which is on paragraph 84. So we support the amendment of the definition of tangtuanui to include land acquired through treaty settlement mechanisms, such as RFRs and deferred purchase rights, as well as land returned under treaty settlements. And I think my instinct is to say acquired through treaty settlement mechanisms, whether one needs to specify RFRs and deferred purchase rights. I don't think it should necessarily. There's a scope thing if it was any money, like $100 million back under treaty settlement, or bought a bunch of land. Perhaps, which may or may not be.
That was going to be the next question, because I see in the next paragraph here.
Yes,
So
if I can address that point, at this point, and I'm saying at this point, the River Review do not support the expansion of the definition of Tangata Whenua ancestral land to include general land owned by Māori. And the issues that raises, first, is an uncertainty about nature and scale of the effect of that extension, given and what it brings into the picture, because that's essentially taking what we look at in terms of treaty settlements, in terms of Māori freehold land that is held effectively broadly within distinct groupings of whānau, of the large whānau, or hapū, or iwi, and certainly in the secondary settlement space by iwi. That in most cases, if not the vast majority of cases, that is a mana whenua connection to the land. In most cases, particularly if the church ends up with Māori freehold land and the Crown relocates and iwi from the Wairarapa. But those kind of examples aside, it does open up a whole lot of issues and what happens with jointly owned land there. What's Māori owned and what's not Māori owned with owners. So there's that aspect of it, but also, and it probably builds upon that issue of disconnect with the essential element of tangata whenua in the sense, RMA sense, of iwi hapū whānau holding mana whenua with the catchment. The prospect, for example, and I won't name an iwi, but let's just call them Ngāti X from the South Island, buying a large dairy farm in the middle of the Waikato and taking advantage of tangata whenua ancestral land provisions that are designed to remove the barriers and reconnect the mana whenua and tangata whenua of the Waikato with their lands is a...
You're happy for tangata whenua to be able to develop their lands if they're mana whenua,
yes,
in that area, as opposed to external people coming in, utilising
and again, this isn't targeted to anybody, but it does raise a spectrum of gaming and purchasing through agency in all kinds of different ways in which, and I think it's just, there might be a basis of doing that if you could build in that mana whenua in an appropriate way. I mean, I suspect even without thinking about it, if Waikato were to go down and buy some land in the middle of Ngāti Tauwhawa's territory, even though they're within the fold of River Iwi, even that's a little bit. Mm-hmm. I mean, it'll fit potentially within the class if it's Māori freehold land, or perhaps if it's somehow been through an RFR, so I doubt that would be an RFR down there. But the sensitivities that one needs to manage, and there might be a way of, if you were going to expand it to general land owned by Māori of drafting a clause that linked the Māori to having to be mana whenua, tangata whenua, but within the relevant region. But I think you can certainly end up with a whole bunch of scraps about that, which is precisely what I received clear direction at the outset not to bring before this court. But I think that's a way of managing it. I think it's worth thinking about. But from an iwi perspective, seen from an iwi perspective, they have been concerned in a number of other frameworks and processes and legislative processes of this kind of homogenisation of Māori and Māori rights in relation to te taiao and the environment, where it gets individualised, so every Māori gets to exercise this right, even though those rights are bedded in kawa tikanga, whakapapa, that is held and exercised within a distinct grouping. I don't want to belabor it, but that's what's just... It's not a superficial response or a flippant one, because I appreciate what sits behind raising that issue and my friend advancing it, but I think some caution is required and not yet, and not on those terms. And there's no criticism of my friend or his client for advancing it. Now, finally, connected with that, those things for ancestral land divisions, if those changes are made, including the new rule and policies directed to Tangata ancestral land, the river you consider that the non-compliant land use can otherwise then remain in its current form and doesn't need to have that end date reintroduced. However, to the extent there's been a suggestion that the effective start date within that rule shift, that's not supported by the river iwi for two reasons. One, unknown consequences of how much land beyond that advanced low-lying pasture is going to fit within that category. We've seen unforeseen effects of things before that slip through. And secondly, with all due respect, well made, lawfully under codes of compliance, that was done and those land use changes were affected in the knowledge of PC1's development and its likely contents and continue beyond its notification. And Section 28 makes it clear that within 6 months of it becoming operative, you just seek a resource consent. And knowing and listening and understanding that the practices of Wairaki Forestry are acting absolutely extreme in terms of mitigation and setbacks and on-farm practices in terms of mitigating their discharges and retiring into forestry and native bush, etc. One would reasonably hope that they would, if they are as good as they ought to be, they can fit through whatever that rule is. In any event, there's I think the letter from the council to Wairaki Pastoral, which I was put to the witness by my friends of the council, they were on notice that they would need to get a consent under PC1. So shifting the goalpost now is essentially taking them out of a statutory obligation, and they only have a legal argument that that statutory obligation doesn't apply to them. That's a different matter. You don't need to change the date if it doesn't apply to them. So that's my submission in that regard. Freshwater accounting framework, finally. The river area are obviously concerned to ensure, for reasons not only connected to some of the ancestral land development, but more generally and more importantly, the progress towards the 35 mana. The first 10-year 20% improvement target is realistically able to be met, as the modelling and the development of PC1 suggests, and more so that by the time we are able to ascertain whether that production target has been met, and more preferably still, that we are able to ascertain progress against that target far sooner than that. Now, in a freshwater accounting framework, and inevitably the development of a new methodology in view of continued and identified limitations with overseer must be progressed without delay. It's essential to the success of PC1 as multiple experts before the court have agreed. This work should have commenced, led by counsel in 2016. Those methods have been in PC1 since the state of notification. The river area are greatly troubled that matters appear to still be at an embryonic stage. This may refer to securing some funding for scoping studies at this stage. while delivery, we acknowledge that the court cannot address this in terms of make it happen through the terms of PC1 alone, delivery, we will welcome the strongest expression from the court in its decision regarding this imperative. Linked to this, and despite the absence at present of an appropriate framework or model, it is vital that all relevant data that will likely be required to input into a future framework or model is collected now and on an ongoing basis and collated and maintained by the Council. That the data required should be especially recorded within the relevant provisions of PC1, whether that's within the standards, the farm planning requirements, etc. And I think supplementary speaking points which you can talk to, he's identified some of the matters that may need to be collated in that respect. And I think there's a range of things that have been identified, both on farm, climatic, and stream. One of the observations, having listened to other evidence, is that while there is on stream and stream monitoring in place, those locations have been set up based on flood protection measurements first, and the soil water quality is incidental to those locations, and we're not talking about GPS 24/7 data coming through, whereas we know those systems exist. But there does need to be an effort in terms of developing such a framework. It will need to be funded, and as I say in paragraph 91, these processes should be led by the Council and progressed on a collaborative basis involving River Iwi and other Iwi Hapu sector groups, the Crown and the Waikato River Authority. As the Te Rewa Mana states, we are all responsible and we must work together towards that common goal, which is essential to all our futures. In addition to the particular matters addressed in these submissions, a key imperative of the River Iwi remains their PC1 finalised and fully operative without reasonable delay. It is already more than 7 years since PC1 was notified. We are fast approaching not only an interrelated partial plan change process to address the NPS of FM 2020, but a period of some uncertainty or at least transition in terms of the new Natural and Built Environment Act 2023. Certainty about where we stand now in terms of PC1 and the immediate steps ahead would at least bring some sense of stability and a basis from which to move forward into the future. It will also, just as a final note, provide an additional and important point of focus for the current review of Te Tiri Whamana that is being conducted by the Waikato River Authority, in which Mr. Penta talked about, and noting that that review includes, within its potential scope, the addition of targets and methods within Te Tiri Whamana. And as I explored with Mr. Penta in evidence, that doesn't go through a Schedule 1 type process, that there is a public process, but that is a somewhat sharper tool to get targets and methods in action in. And no one's suggesting that that's the preferred methodology, but if we are not able to get these methods up and running and moving, then recourse towards those ends. And it's a process that involves the Waikato River Authority conducting this public process, then making a recommendation about amending to Te Rewa Mana to add targets and methods. That recommendation is made to the Minister for the Environment and to the Five River Iwi at this stage, two other Iwi are added to that mix, and they jointly approve that, and the Minister then makes a recommendation to the Governor-General and its respective Board of Council, so that there is a statutory process for that to occur. But even the observations and by this court and PC1 lands will be an important matter for the Waikato River Authority to take into account. And it's considering, does it need to do more now at this stage? Can we rely on the RMA processes and practices and methodologies to deliver? So that's just a final observation in that respect. Before I call the first witness, we'll be going to do it in the order of Mr. Lowe, then Mr. Osei, and then Mr. Brough. I just wanted to, on behalf of the Rotary, we just acknowledge, particularly in this part of the process, the contribution that all of the parties, the legal counsel and witnesses, have made to the process. It has been, despite the adversarial contest in the areas, a collegial process, and through the number of discussions at the back of the court, a collaborative process, working towards finding solutions to problems. The Rotary want to particularly acknowledge the time and efforts that individual farmers from all sectors have taken in terms of input and participation. I think a particular shout out to Mr. Pinnell for his not only his persistence, patience, tenacity, but also the level of his involvement in questioning. I think the late career change available, I suspect, if he wants it. Having been an engineer and now a farmer, might be another role ahead. But that's been valuable, and it just reinforces the importance that when this court issues its judgment, subject to the final steps that we have got, I think it's critical, as I said earlier, in the Rotary, I think it's critical that all parties come back together in the spirit of collaboration in the path of implementation and the additional steps that we know need to be taken in the short term and the longer term, through pooling resource, through pooling funding. We can probably access some better funding effectively, identify the problems and then collaborate towards solutions. Perhaps if that occurred over the 7-year kind of hiatus since the collaborative stakeholder group, possibly maybe a lot more advanced than we are. But subject to any further questions, those are my submissions for the Rotary.
Just in terms of the evidence and looking at the statements, I needed additional speaking points. I am conscious of the point made by Mr. Meyer. It does seem to me that in terms of where we go with this, and I don't want to cut people off unnecessarily, but it may well be in terms of what I perceive to be the content. If we may receive these statements now, and they can be the subject of any further or reply submissions in relation to their proposals for changes to be made. But I'm not certain whether or not we should embark on a process with statements filed yesterday of opening up for any wide-ranging cross-examination of them today, given the constraints on time.
Yes, I suppose by way of approach, probably it doesn't help that we come at the end in that respect, as with all due respect, a number of parties have made some quite extensive supplementary comments and additions to their evidence, and I could have stood up and asked a range of questions in that regard. But I thought the sensible thing was to ask them if they had reflections and things that they thought would add value. And I would emphasise to all parties these are intended to be constructive inputs rather than positional advocacy, because that is not the direction any of them have received, is that it was more useful for them to write that up in that way and to circulate it, because I understand that some council do have questions that arise from that. I wasn't sure how, on that basis, we should deal with them today, as to whether I need to leave, or I was going to say, these are now supplementary statements of evidence.
Well, I'm not proposing excluding them.
No.
I'm just saying that in terms of how we proceed, on the basis that we have made certain plans in terms of concluding the hearing today, I just want to try and ensure we do that. However, I acknowledge that we ought not to let that defeat the evidential process that we're going through. It's just that what I do read in these additional commentary suggestions, as with Mr. Bruff's notes for amendments, matters relating to the text of the plan change that we can probably assess and understand on the papers and just make it clear that parties will have an opportunity. I have to say, for myself at least, it's not always the most effective way of addressing proposed plan provisions.
Perhaps I just suggest, I think, because I know we all found ourselves in a position where we're all asking questions on the new chief of sea, on the hoof, as it were. Mr. Brock has had some collegial conversations,
yes.
And some conversations with council, so it may be that there are some particular questions that
yes.
will readily bring some matters out, but not if we're talking about lengthy inquisitions, then I don't think any of us are seeking that, and I agree that those matters can be addressed by submission, but I think if there is some utility in asking some questions arising from those, then
yes.
The witnesses are here for that purpose, and I would be pleased to assist.
Let's go through the process and see how it goes.
Excellent. So,
Sarah, I'm not sure if it's of any assistance to signal that for my part, I've spoken to both the witnesses indicating what I'd like to ask them so they can start thinking about it, and that it relates to matters of practical farm implementation, so matters of fact, so to speak,
yes.
that will feed into the definition, but if it is useful, I have no desire, nor would I see it helpful, to cross-examine them up and down Dale about where a comma goes, so to speak, being glib, but if you understand the sentiment.
No, well, I don't think it's glib at all, Mr. Thompson. I think that it highlights something that I was also thinking myself. And thank you for that indication.
Thank you, sir. So if there's any further indication, I'd be grateful to receive it, otherwise I'll get on.
Thank you.
So if I can, I'll call it Hamish Tinty Lowe.
Thank you.
There is only sincerely and truly declare and affirm that the evidence you're about to give to this court shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
I do.
Mr. Lowe, can you confirm that your full name is Hamish Timothy Lowe?
Yes, sir.
And you're an environmental scientist with Lowe Environmental Impact Limited?
Yes, sir.
And you prepared a brief of evidence in this proceeding dated 28 July 2023 and a brief of rebuttal evidence dated 14 August 2023.
Correct.
And you participated in the Farm Systems Joint Witness Statement?
Yes, I
did. And do you swear that those matters are true, matters in your brief evidence, and your statements, as part of your statements, are true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
Yes, I did.
Are there any corrections or additions in terms of your brief of evidence or the rebuttal evidence that you need to make?
No, I have it.
And you've also prepared the speaking notes and put into one side the status of those are also true and correct to the best of your knowledge.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Just answer any questions that you may have, unless you wish to, I think, which goes, you don't need to, he doesn't need to speak to those, I don't think.
Let's see what emerges.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Sweet.
Thank you.
I'm a super legal counsel for the Director General of Conservation. Just got a question for you regarding paragraph 10 of your speaking notes, if you've got those in front of you. So in that paragraph 10, about the fifth line down, you start a sentence where there is an inflow from an ephemeral flow path. I recommend that planners increase the width. So I'm just interested in two parts of that sentence. One is, the first part is inflow from an ephemeral flow path. So my question to you is it the inflow to the other water bodies bodies that makes it in female a critical factor?
Yes, I suppose that's just for our interpretation on what I'm meaning there. Where a femoral flow path reaches the secondary water body, if it's come from a critical source area or there's a high risk of contaminants being present, then it's logical to offer a high level of protection to the secondary waterway where the passage is into.
And where it inflows
into. Yeah, where it inflows into that secondary waterway.
Thank you. I just have a further clarification question. So, in terms of, do you know what proportion of feminine and intermittent strains have femoral inflows?
No, I don't.
So, I guess, taking a step back from that, in terms of how river systems receive their water, you have groundwater springs and femoral streams.
Yeah, there could be a reasonable hierarchy. Probably the common swanky method of the first question is just asking. It's probably, well, it's shown that Dr. Asay and myself have discussed that he's probably best answer that.
Okay, I'll pick that up with Dr. Asay. Thank you. So my next question relates to, do you have the water quality JWS? That's in volume 411, tab 1, 401, 0001.
The dark, yes, that one.
Can you repeat the tab 1?
Tab 1. That's the water quality data. So yes, that's returning to the second part of your sentence where you talked about recommending that planners increase the width. So in that water quality JWS, at question 37, there's a diagram there, and that references 4010024.
Yes.
So my question here relates to setback distances. And have you, when I look at that graph, have you heard of the optimal performance curve?
I'm familiar with optimal performance curves. I'm aware of this data and this reporting, but I'm not too sure exactly what.
Where I'm heading?
Where you're
heading. Yeah, so I guess when I look at this kind of beginning of a curve, and that you kind of think of like optimal performance in terms of, I guess, in terms of working, you have your morning at the bottom, you're asleep, you have your coffee, and then as you wake up, you kind of head towards optimal performance.
Sure, yes, yeah.
And then as the coffee kicks in, you get closer and closer to optimal, then you drink too much coffee, and then you go over the other side of the curve.
Yes.
And,
the middle of the concept.
Yes. So, I guess in terms of this graph here, it's got the setback distances at the bottom, and as you go up, it's kind of heading towards what it classifies as optimal performance. So, I think from a farm system cost perspective, if you set the setback distance at, I guess, in that optimal flow state, performance stage, in the long run, that would be more cost effective, wouldn't it, to do that from the beginning of the process?
I'm not too sure. I think, if I understand correctly, targeting the right setback, is that what you're referring to? You target the right setback?
To get the gains?
Yes.
Yes, needed to achieve the
targets. Sure. Yes.
And if you set that wrong at the beginning and you track it, say 20 years' time, you're like, oh, we're not tracking well, we need to do other measures. It may have been better to set that distance better at the beginning.
I think we could apply that to a lot of things in life, not just setback distances. So hindsight's a wonderful thing. But I think based on the information that we collectively currently have, there's a series of judgment calls that need to be made. And we here, they're optimal points that to the script as a descriptor describing almost an optimization in terms of sediment efficiency. But there's a number of other factors that we have to go into that decision making if we actually place that piece.
So I guess, potentially 3, 4, 10.
There's a range, and I think it comes back to diligent guidance as a farm planner as to identify what are the risks of that particular location. And if there are higher risks, such as a critical resource area, well, you take a more proportionary approach and move for a higher setback. Whereas if you were in an area where there was obviously no opening flow because you're dealing with a crest of a bank and water did not physically flow over it, it wouldn't make any sense to go further than the bed.
Thank you. And I'd like to move to the definition of critical source areas. I see that we've all been correctly with the definition. And I see that you've helpfully set out a definition at your paragraph 21 about your speaking notes. Moving register, I've just got a document to. So I think, as you're aware, we've all got different versions and we're all kind of grappling. And I just wanted to, just the documents coming to you now is probably out.
This is an advance on the one that you provided us a few days ago.
Correct.
Thank you.
And so I'm not sure if you do, I have some questions for Ms. Mara around the definition of critical source areas and for some online questions around the definition. So I have a question, and I've accidentally put my own version, but I can't remember what it says. So the, I guess the structure is pretty similar. So we've got a and a B, and then move into examples. So I think your two bullet points and your two examples are essentially that. Thank you. The first bullet point is the landscape feature, and the second bullet point would be a non-landscape feature. Is that how you characterise those two different?
Yeah, I have. I suppose looking at a little bit of exercise last week, including I think some of the shared suggestions that have been made by Doc, lining up side by side, and there's a lot of commonality. From my perspective, critical source areas can effectively be broken into two parts, as I've got in my notes. Aspects that form part of the landscape, particularly the topography, that may lead to the generation of larger catchment areas. Contaminants within that larger catchment area is being channelized to receiving water. The other is specific pieces of infrastructure, such as a track, a water trough, feeding areas, or that might be a freshwater spring if you want to exclude the stock out. So that's why in my suggestion I have made the distinction between considering landform and infrastructure.
And it's
interesting that despite coming from different ends at different times, we largely arrive at the same point. And I think it's illustrated by the examples that you have. Those two bullet points are, while they're slightly different to the wording that I've chosen, they effectively say the same thing.
That's how I was reading that. And I think moving to the earlier part B above, I want to do some of the discussion around that. So I think, I guess the part B in the DG version is contaminant pathway to downstream surface water bodies. And your part B has the potential to result in the loss of a large quantity of contaminants to downstream surface water bodies when compared to adjacent land use.
Yeah, I think that this is probably where there's a little bit of a fundamental difference in views of different parties. I come from a land management perspective. I think some of the other contributors have probably come from a surface water or water quality perspective. From my perspective, when we were source theories, we're actually talking about the landscape of the water body. It's the landscape that ends up in the water body. So we, from my perspective, the primary focus should be on that landscape. While we have to understand the water body and where it goes to, but we need to control the landscape, and that's why the distinction or the difference between your suggested B and what I'd suggested B is there's a different focus. I'm talking about landscape, and I think you're referring to the pathways which is more that the better.
Yeah, and I think, because I was looking at that in terms of, I guess your paragraph B kind of sets the threshold in terms of large quantity. And a question I just wanted to put for explore with you is that I guess we could deal with the threshold in the definition or in the plan provisions, and where I'm headed with this is that in terms of for the definition to stand the test of time, if we end up in a scenario down the track where I guess adaptive management actions are needed, the actions could be taken in terms of bringing those thresholds down in the plan provisions rather than tinkering to the definition, in the sense that if there is a need to bring that threshold down, the definition being a bit more pure may give more flexibility for that adaptive.
I think there's probably a couple of elements in there. One's very much from a planning perspective and how you, the mechanism for managing that, and if I'd like to park together, that's probably something that Mr. Proctor to cover. But from my perspective, I think that there is a need for clarity to be able to talk about specifically or identify specifically what you're talking about. And if we're just referring to contaminant pathways, it's quite general. As to what we're referring to. In this case, we're talking about the land and the land use.
Thank you. That was useful. I think that might be my last question. Just check. Yes, that's my question. Thank you.
Hello. Below. I have two questions or two topics I wish to ask you about, and both are largely by way of, well, the first is largely by way of clarification, the second is perhaps a little bit more substantive. In your paragraph, well, from about paragraph 12, but in your paragraph 15, you refer to an attachment A. And attachment A are a handful of maps that have had LIDAR data overlaid upon them, is that right?
Correct.
And I just did a quick Google search last night for one of the roads on that map, Shark's Tooth Road, so I figured there couldn't be too many of them, and there aren't. And I found that that was in Winton, north of Invercargill, is that right?
That's correct.
So I just want to get clear the basis for my own benefit of, as much as anything, that you're offering this information up. Is the reason you're offering this information to demonstrate how a LIDAR map overlaid can provide more precision in the mapping, the slope identification in PC1?
Yeah, that's exactly correct, and I think I don't know whether you've spotted it to the side of those images. There's a percentage of area within slope classes.
Yes.
And I think that's a key part of the little group analysis that I've done in terms of the MFB, low slope, 5% covers 92% of the farm, whereas if you apply the LIDAR data, the 5% is reduced to 59%.
Right, so the
the underlying point here is that if we provide a pathway that allows this additional layer of analysis, we're going to get a more accurate result when it comes to identification.
And that there was the sort of idea behind providing it, is that at the moment the readily available information for everybody is pretty coarse. But there's an opportunity to use technology, preferably boots off the ground, where that's not possible, use the technology. In this case, LiDAR, we can be more accurate about not only identifying the waterways that need protection, but the constraints that may be around the waterways.
Okay, all right, well, that's helpful. You also go on to refer, I think, in your paragraph 16 to, my words, not yours, this greater precision, meaning that from a practical perspective, cross-slope fences can be avoided. Do you remember that?
Yes.
And as I understand it, the reason we want to avoid cross-slope fences, because you told me in the break, is because in flood events and large rainfall events, they get washed away because everything pushes down the hill and gets caught up and pushes the fence over. Is it as simple as that, or is there a subtlety that's worth getting into?
Probably just a little correction there. It's not so much what comes down the water itself, it's what comes off the land.
Right.
And if you have a lot of rain, you potentially have movement to that hillside can bring the fence closer to the waterway.
Sure.
So using the precise aerial imagery, you can actually get a handle as to those areas that are vulnerable for movement, and then they can be afforded with different levels of management, whether it be fencing, tree planting, a range of different tools.
So can you just help me understand how the LiDAR method will help with that outcome?
Oh, sure. It basically allows you to identify those areas. And I suppose if we turn to those images, there are a number of areas on that farm where you can very easily pick up steep faces that might have susceptibility for movement, mass motion, which would mean that fence would disappear, because it would not much disappear, but would become closer to that waterway. So you would either consider taking that fence further away, or looking at, in combination with that fencing, different land management of that area. So you could effectively treat it as a critical source area, because there was land that could end up in the waterway, and you should be looking at tools or mechanisms to keep that land on the hillside of the waterway.
Okay, all right, thank you. Now, you're still on this topic of slopes. Mr. Brough, you might be aware, has prepared an amended Schedule C. Are you familiar with the amended Schedule C he's prepared and has, your council has given to the court?
Yes, I am.
Now, in that amended Schedule C, he refers to a further alternative for assessing the slope of that paddock, and that's if the land is found to be different when measured over any 20 metre distance. Have you consulted, talked to him about that?
Yes,
as part of the provision. There's been quite a bit of debate at various times about how one could do that, and I was just interested, given Mr. Brough has made the suggestion, what your view is on how practically an assessment of that nature could work, firstly on farm, by the farmer.
There are a number of very simple tools you could use on farm if you're a farmer who works on the ground. You use 20 metres from a waterway, you get a staff pole or a measuring gauge, and you simply eyeball it. And the combination of those two means, allows you to determine what that slope might be. Equally, there are a number of gadgets you can use, cavity levels, apps on your phone, that would allow you to calculate that slope point.
And would you say that, should that information be recorded in a farm plan and certified by a certified farm planner? Or is that over-egging the matter a bit much?
No, I think it definitely is part of that farm plan process. And that's where there are a number of tools you could use in conjunction. I think most farm planners would agree that if you use the EFB low slope mapping, you should try and validate or determine the accuracy of that on your particular farm. If you have other tools available, such as LiDAR, drone surveys, whatever it might be, you could use that information to have greater confidence in your planning.
Okay. All right, thank you. Second topic, second to last,